Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 14th of October. As international concern grows about the attacks on UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon, Israel has apparently carried out an airstrike on a village in a mainly Christian region in the north of the country. We get reaction from the Lebanese government and from the Red Cross. Also, the Trade Minister Douglas Alexander on the government's investment summit. We hear why Northern Rail has dropped the prosecutions of some rail card users. And we speak to the German historian whose detective work in the Stasi archives has helped to bring a murder conviction in a Cold War cold case 50 years later. The war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon continues to develop in new and unpredictable ways. Tonight, the UN Security Council has been holding a closed emergency meeting as Israeli forces stand accused of deliberately targeting UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. Well, the capital, Beirut, is not at the moment experiencing nightly airstrikes as it was last week, but new areas of the country are finding themselves in the firing line. Today, for the first time in this latest stage of the conflict between Israel and the Iranian-backed militia, what's believed to be an Israeli missile struck a village in a predominantly Christian region of northern Lebanon. I got the details of the casualties in the village of Aitou from George Ketane, Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross.
There's 21 dead bodies and there's 9 injuries transferred to the hospitals. Also, we are continuing with our urban search and rescue team and with other NGOs to do a search and rescue to see if there's other people under the ground, because the building is 3-4 floors, I think. This is why we are continuing now.
What can you tell us about the area where this strike took place?
It's a peaceful, a touristic area. It's a place where the people go during the summer. And it's a building where you have IDPs and there's women and children and families.
So these IDPs, these internally displaced people, have they arrived there since this particular war began?
As you know, you have more than 1.2 million IDPs. They left the south, the Bekaa and suburb of Beirut, to the north, to Mount Lebanon, and to other areas, safety area. They are not all in big shelters. They are renting houses, hotels. As you know, they thought they are going for some days only.
Is it possible that there were members of Hezbollah amongst them?
We have women and children and others. For us, we didn't see any arms, anything.
George Ketane, Secretary General of the Lebanese Red Cross. Well, Lebanon's finance minister is Youssef Khalil. He told me about the economic impact that airstrikes such as this one are having on his country.
For a long time during this part of the war, it was agreed, in writing or not, I don't know, but it was agreed that the villages would be attacked, would be, unfortunately to say it, sometimes destroyed. However, the cities would not. And 10 days ago, the cities like Sur, you know, in South Lebanon, like Sidon in South Lebanon as well, were attacked. Now, North Lebanon was attacked heavily, I would say, something that did not happen for a long time. Trade was starting to increase to the better.
So you're saying this is going to have a big economic impact on the country, that the war is moving to the north?
Yes. Not only to the north, it's attacking as well the cities.
Are you worried, though, just to come back to the fact that the war now and the Israeli attacks are moving to different parts of the country, are you worried with so many displaced people that Hezbollah could be among them and that the Israelis will be attacking new targets because perhaps Hezbollah is using this opportunity to move around the country?
It's not their way of doing things, as far as I can tell.
Lebanon's finance minister. Well, the Israel Defense Forces have not commented on this specific incident in the north of Lebanon, but the IDF spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, told the BBC that Israel was going after Hezbollah in a systematic way.
Our assessment suggests that there have been several thousand, or over 1,000 Hezbollah terrorists that have been taken out. Since the operations against Hezbollah have begun, they have stopped releasing the names of their terrorists that have been killed, which is not something that they've done over the last year. Over the last year, they were celebrating each and every one of the terrorists that have been killed. Amazingly, they have stopped and making those announcements. So I would say the operations are conducted in a way which identifies the specific locations.
The BBC's Jonathan Head is in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. I asked him how unusual was the attack on the village in the north of Lebanon called Aitou.
It's very unusual in that area, not unprecedented. We had a couple of attacks in the north over the weekend, I think on Saturday, but nearly all of the airstrikes, and there are dozens every day, and it's hard to keep count of them, are in the south, of course, where Israeli land forces are also engaged with Hezbollah. This is a known stronghold of Hezbollah in the deep south of Lebanon and in the Bekaa Valley. Hezbollah has a very strong presence there too. We haven't had airstrikes in Beirut over the last couple of days, but when there have been in the last 3 weeks, most of those again have been in the southern suburbs. The village of Aitu is an odd one. This is a Christian Maronite village, a very small village up in the mountains. I don't think anyone there could have imagined they would be a target, and there's clearly a huge amount of shock among the residents, and there's fewer than 1,000 people who live there, and they got no warning. In many cases, the Israeli Defense Forces have warned some areas that they will be hit, although often those warnings are quite don't give them very much time to move out. But there was no warning here. All the residents have described is suffering the most colossal blast, in an enormous pile of rubble in the middle of the village. Lots of vehicles smashed. Lots of people hurt. I mean, a really dreadful scene.
What is being said then about why this might have been targeted?
Nothing from the Israelis yet. They might, given the amount of publicity it's getting. I've seen them do it in other cases to give an explanation. But interestingly, some of the, talking to the local residents, they're saying, look, in recent months, actually, they've had quite a number of people come up from the deep south of Lebanon, the Shiite south, where most of the fighting is now, who've been displaced and have moved into this village. It's an unusual village. There's a very old one, but Aitu's population is small, and most of its inhabitants emigrated to the United States during the Lebanese Civil War in the 1970s and 80s. So the population's quite small. It may be there are quite a few empty buildings, and so quite a few families have moved in from the south. And they did say that the house that was targeted was rented out to somebody. It had been empty and was rented out to somebody just 2 weeks ago. So putting two and two together, it's possible that whoever took that house was somebody on an Israeli target list. But this raises real problems in Lebanon because there are so many displaced people. There are hundreds of thousands, particularly from the areas that have been really heavily targeted by the Israelis, many of them people from Hezbollah areas. They need to stay somewhere, but now increasingly Lebanese are saying to me, we don't want them staying with us because we don't know if they're going to bring somebody with us who is a target. This entire country is living in fear now. I mean, I can't tell you what it's like to be sitting in Beirut, right in the heart of Beirut, and hearing constantly above us, really quite close, Israeli drones seeking out targets. And this is really unnerving people. They just don't know where Israel's information will direct them next, and you don't get warning. There's suddenly just this whoosh, a massive bang, and you've got really, even if the Israelis get the target they want, there are always significant civilian casualties and horrible destruction.
Meanwhile, no matter how much damage has been done to Hezbollah, they still have the ability to strike back, to send missiles and drones into Israel, and over the weekend to kill members of the IDF.
Yes, and it's interesting. Hezbollah has been relatively quiet in recent weeks. Obviously, a huge amount of damage has been done to their organization, to their leadership. But in the last 48 hours, we had a very strong warning from them on Saturday, warning Israelis, stay away from army bases. We will be targeting them. I think also a bit of virtue signaling, telling their own people, hey, we only target military targets. We only go after military targets. Then this surprisingly destructive attack by a drone, which clearly managed to evade Israel's generally very impressive defences. And another statement, a much longer statement from Hezbollah today, saying this was a message to show you what we're capable of. You need to know that we're capable of a lot more. And that, you know, you were foolish to think that you degraded our abilities. Now, Israel's estimate is that they have actually done enormous damage to Hezbollah. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that he thinks they've only got about one third of their missile stockpiles and rocket stockpile left. But that's a big stockpile. That was more than 100,000. So, you know, the fact it's a reality. This conflict's going to go on. And Hezbollah does have the capacity to hit back, and it's shown it at the weekend. And I think that was a bit of a shock to Israel after 3 weeks in which it's had enormous success against Hezbollah.
That was the BBC's Jonathan Head in Beirut. And coming up later on in the programme, 35 years after this...
The gates have been thrown open and thousands of people are pouring over to take a look at a West. In some cases, their first look, and the elation is enormous.
The legacy of the Berlin Wall still casts its shadow as a former East German Stasi officer is convicted of a murder he committed half a century ago. We'll bring you all the details. Now, at the beginning of the big investment summit in London today, the Prime Minister promised to scrap regulations. It was one of the key messages the government wanted to send to potential investors at the same time as trumpeting the billions of pounds of overseas investment it already has in the bag, with concerns in some quarters about the implications for business of Labour's employment rights bill. That was a message the private sector wanted to hear, as the former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, told Keir Starmer during this on-stage exchange.
Maybe instead of calling it regulation and investment, you should call it a lot of investment and very small amount of regulation. Or maybe you need a minister of anti-regulation. a more serious proposal is that democracies, especially something as long as old as this one, have so many ways in which people can say no. I'd much rather, and I think the business community would much rather, have a single person who can say yes or no and who says no, and then they can move on. The cost of capital and the delay is killing you.
Well, no minister for anti-regulation just yet, but there is a minister of state for trade and economic security. It's Douglas Alexander. And I asked him about the timing of the summit more than a fortnight before the budget. Would businesses have committed more investments if they had had the certainty of knowing the Chancellor's fiscal plans?
This summit's taken place, what, just over 100 days since July the 4th, the date of the election, and the fact that we assembled, what, 300 of the world's leading business people, I think is testimony to the fact that it was well-judged and well-timed. Of course, we've got a big date in a couple of weeks' time when Rachel, the first female chancellor in centuries, will set out the fiscal position. But the fact that we've secured commitments in excess of £60 billion, generating about 38,000 jobs, we think is a tribute not just to the organisation, but to the central message that the Prime Minister was communicating in the Guildhall today, which is both that Britain is back on the international stage and Britain is open for business.
Also that Britain is going to cut regulation. And one of the ways this is going to happen, we understand, is by reviewing the Competition and Markets Authority, perhaps other regulators as well. Do you have any details about what that review will entail?
Well, in the CMA, let's see the terms of the review when it emerges. But let me give you the example that the Prime Minister cited to try and describe the importance of what he was talking about. He talked about a wind farm in the east of England where developers want to generate clean power, something we would all surely agree is the right way to go for the United Kingdom. And yet they've been required, the developers, to produce 4,000 documents, not 400 or 40 documents, but 4,000 documents to different public authorities. That example speaks to me to the fact that we must and should do a better job in making sure that the public authorities are pro-growth rather than inadvertently stifling the kind of growth we all need to see.
But how do you achieve that without perhaps cutting corners or the work that regulators, the important work that regulators do, taking perhaps a longer-term view on projects, being watered down?
I don't see growth as being anything other than a longer-term view. I think we have to break out of what's a historic and erroneous binary conversation between no regulation or too much regulation. None of us want to see these projects buried in bureaucracy, but equally, all of us want to see smart, intelligent regulation that does guarantee standards, for example, of health or safety or certain consumer rights. What the Prime Minister was arguing for, and the CMA review is part of this, is that we need a more sophisticated, strategic approach to regulation.
When it comes to the bigger economic picture, again, in which today's summit is being held, is it a strange time again to be calling on businesses around the world to invest when there are a number of government policies recently announced that would arguably place a lot more burden on start-up businesses in this country, such as the Employment Rights Bill or indeed reports, and I'm sure you're not going to wade into what may or may not be in the budget, but capital gains tax perhaps being significantly increased. No denial again today from the Chancellor and others that the employers' national insurance contributions will also rise at the budget.
Jamie, what did we inherit on July the 5th when we took government? We had a toxic combination of low growth and high inequality. And it's right that we address both of those challenges. What's the route to higher growth, higher investment, higher productivity, and in turn, higher wages? How do we deal with inequality? In part by strengthening the employment rights of workers. It is simply wrong that we have so many workers living precarious lives, receiving text messages on their way to work, telling them whether they've got a shift or not. So I don't see there as being a contradiction or a tension between employing people on a reasonable and fair basis, the New Deal for Working People legislation that we've just announced, and on the other hand, saying to international investors, we want to compete in a high-value, high-productivity, high-growth economy.
Can I ask about one of those international investors? One of the companies that has pledged £20 billion over 5 years is the Australian company Macquarie on various projects that include electric car charging network. But of course, it's the company that saddled Thames Water with huge debts when it owned it between 2006 and 2017. Are you comfortable with doing business with them?
Well, you'd appreciate, given the fragility of Thames Water at the moment, I'm not going to go into the detail of the present corporate structure or the challenges that are faced in the immediate term.
No, it's a question about Macquarie.
But let me just come to your main point. I was actually sitting next to Steve Reid, the Environment Secretary, today on the second row of the audience listening to the Prime Minister set out his case that Britain was open for business. Steve Reid, as the Environment Secretary, is already getting down to work, sorting out, frankly, the regulatory failure and regulatory mess that we inherited in the water industry. So if you're asking me, do I recognise there have been profound and challenging problems in Thames Water, 100%. Do those problems need to be sorted out? Absolutely. But what is the responsibility of government in those situations? It's to make sure that the regulatory framework is appropriate and that we create an environment in which capital can be deployed in the future. And in that sense, the responsibility of sorting out the problem of Thames Water rests both with the government and with the regulatory authorities, but we're already getting down to work on that as well.
Right. Just back to Macquarie, though. That's what the question was about. A company that, during its time as shareholder, extracted £879 million in dividends as the company's debt burden increased from £6 billion to £11 billion.
Yeah, it's a sorry tale of failure, but principally there was a regulatory environment that abjectly failed the consumer and the company and the sector. And in that sense, that's why I welcome the steps that Steve has taken already to deal proactively with the challenges that we encountered just 3 months ago. And at the same time, it's right to say that companies that invest globally around the world, we need to be talking to try and secure the investment that we need going forward.
That was Douglas Alexander, Minister of State for Trade and Economic Security. And there's quite a lot about the budget, the upcoming budget, speculation at this stage in the papers tomorrow. The budget on the 30th of October, of course. The Guardian reports that Rachel Reeves hints at budget increase in employer national insurance. The Independent says new national insurance hike warning for UK businesses from Reeves. And on the front of the business pages of the Daily Telegraph, tax raid fears are putting off investors. All will be revealed on the 30th. Now we're going to return to a story that we brought you on the programme last week because there's been an update. Now, you may remember on Thursday we heard from two young people who had been on the receiving end of legal action by Northern Rail for using their rail card for discounts before 10 a.m. One of them was Sam Williamson.
I should have bought a ticket that was £5.50 and I think I paid £3.60 for my ticket. I now may be on the hook for potentially hundreds in fines as some other people have been.
Well, according to the National Rail Conditions of Travel, he should have been allowed to pay the £1.90 difference between his discounted fare and the lowest valid price on the spot. Instead, he was the subject of a criminal prosecution. Well, the day after that interview, Sam was told his case had been dropped. And today, Northern has announced it is ending all ongoing prosecutions for this. Early this evening, we caught up with Sam again.
On Friday, I found out that Northern were basically dropping the case against me, which, of course, was, you know, great news for me personally. But at the time, I said, you know, we need to go further. Today, we have started to see some of what that further might look like. We've seen them not taking forward any of the prosecutions that they were considering with the before 10 a.m. usage of the rail card. So I think that's fantastic. And the next step now is making sure that we're doing a thorough review of the previous case that have gone through and making sure that people who I think have been unfairly convicted receive some justice.
What reason have they given you for dropping your case and now all these other cases?
In terms of my case, the main reason was perhaps somewhat nebulous, but the email from Northern began with, "We have reviewed your matter and listened to the concerns you raised on social media and in the press." So obviously they have looked at the facts of my case, but I think this has been much accelerated by how much coverage the issue received. And I'm very thankful to everyone who supported me and all the journalists who helped take up the case too.
Sam Williamson there, I'm thankful not to be facing prosecution by Northern Rail. Well, for our other guest we spoke to on Thursday, though, Keris, the announcement's come a bit late. She was prosecuted by Northern Rail earlier this year and fined £400 for her ticket infraction, and she now has a criminal record. And she's back with us live. Hello, Keris.
Hi, are you okay?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was the same for you, wasn't it? 16 to 25 rail card on the train before 10 a.m. And, well, this ruling initially seems to have come a bit late for you. What do you think about it?
Well, I think it is great for people, obviously, who are feeling the stress and anxiety of facing large fines and possible criminal convictions. I do think it is a good step forward.
For you, does it make any difference?
I think it does give me some hope, obviously, because although it still proves them wrong, so they've dropped it, and that's obviously them saying, right, well, hang on a minute, we're going about it the wrong way. Hopefully they do overturn the criminal conviction that I've got.
You're given hope by this. But just remind us what happened to you. You were told, well, just talk us through what happened.
Yeah, so I was going to work in the morning, which I, you know, as you do, and I was buying a ticket and I was purchasing it from the lady who actually worked at the station. So I handed her my 16 to 25 and she said, yeah, that's fine. Handed me my ticket. I got on the train. It was a valid, you know, it was an in-date 16 to 25. Oh, well, I thought it was anyway, but it was in regards to dates. Got on the train and then was told my ticket was invalid.
In date, but not in time, I suppose.
Yeah.
And did you try to pay on the spot, the difference?
No, they wouldn't let me. I couldn't buy a new ticket, couldn't buy the difference, pay the difference, that is. They just straight up with an incident, what they call as an incident report, which is basically just a gateway to a fine.
Well, I mean, there is a statement that's come from Northern, and let me just read it out. We understand that fares and ticketing across the railway can at times be difficult to understand, and we are reviewing our processes for ensuring compliance with ticket and rail card terms and conditions. And with regard to recent reported cases involving the use of the 16 to 25 rail card with fares under £12 before 10 a.m, we are withdrawing any live cases and will also look to review anyone who has been prosecuted previously on this specific issue. We are actively engaged with government and industry to simplify fares to help customers. So you would fall into that category, anyone who's been prosecuted previously. So,
yeah.
But anything yet? Have you heard anything specifically?
No, I haven't heard anything at all. I have contacted them, and this was before I got in contact, because this has all kind of come about fairly quickly and kind of all at once. And I have contacted them before I got, you know, the first journalist I spoke to got, you know, reports got in touch with me, and they haven't replied at all. So I'm hopeful, yeah, not too hopeful.
The bottom line is, at the moment, I mean, you have a criminal record as a result of this.
I do, yeah, unfortunately.
Well, look, Keris, thanks very much for coming back to us, Keris there, who has already been fined, but possibly, she hopes at least, her case might get reconsidered. Now, a reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight: Lebanese health officials say 21 people have been killed in what they're calling an Israeli strike on I-2 in northern Lebanon. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that businesses could pay higher national insurance contributions. And India and Canada have expelled each other's ambassadors, along with other diplomats, in a bitter row over last year's assassination of a Sikh separatist in British Columbia. I'm going to return now to the Middle East, because the UN has condemned the number of civilian casualties caused by Israeli airstrikes in Gaza over the past few days. A strike on a school that was sheltering displaced people has killed at least 22 people, while at least 10 were killed by artillery fire at a food distribution centre in Jabalia. Since Israel launched its war against Hamas following the deadly attacks on October the 7th of last year, more than 42,000 Gazans have been killed and 95,000 injured. That's according to figures from the Hamas-run health ministry. 2 weeks ago, we spoke to the director of a BBC documentary about the October the 7th Hamas attacks and the Nova Music Festival. It's called We Will Dance Again. And tomorrow night, the BBC will air a new documentary on the suffering amongst Gazans from the year-long war. The film's called Life and Death in Gaza, and it's unique in that it's composed of the video diaries of four Gazans who have filmed their experiences throughout the military campaign. Two of them are Khalid, father of five, and Aya, his 23-year-old daughter, who's also a law graduate. And the BBC Eye's Lara El-Ghabali has their story.
On a table in his apartment, Khalid is dressing the wounds of a young boy.
When the war started, I opened a medical center in my house. I'm a physiotherapist, not really a doctor. This was a big change for me.
Khalid lives in Jabalia, in northern Gaza, one of the areas worst affected by the war. A week into the war in October 2023, the Israeli army told people to evacuate the area and head south. Khalid's four-year-old daughter, Halum, says she doesn't want to leave. Because, she adds, I'm scared of the missiles. With hospitals stretched, Khalid feels that he has to stay and help.
Today I dealt with a child. He was still breathing. If we'd had the means, we would have operated on his brain because he had a hemorrhage. But unfortunately, we had to let him die. There was nothing we could do for him.
Aya was also in northern Gaza, but as the fighting got closer, she moved with her parents and seven siblings to the center.
I came to this shelter school in October. The school seems like the safest place to be at the moment.
In Gaza, nowhere is safe for long. A building next to the school is hit.
There, they've got someone out. Oh my God, body parts.
Khalid and his family in the north are also under threat. In December, a nearby airstrike rocks Khalid's house. I'm afraid, his daughter Halum says. The war is ever-present, even in their games. Khalid watches as his son, Hamoud, pretends to perform surgery on a tiny doll. She's injured, he says. Rubble fell on her.
When I see them like this, my heart breaks. These are not games children should play.
Aya and her family have had to move south to Rafah, where a million people are sheltering.
We're literally living like animals here. We've just received news that our house was destroyed. What do you mean I won't go back to my home, my bed, my room, or anything?
By April, food is running dangerously low. Aeroplanes begin dropping aid.
The amount of aid that falls is very, very small. They are chasing the aid drops. People are fighting each other. People are trying to get aid from the parachutes that were dropped into the sea. Someone's being dragged out now. He was trying to get the aid.
With no food, Khaled's family have to resort to desperate measures. Khaled's children are eating raw weeds.
We eat things knowing that they might poison us, but we do it because there is no alternative.
In June, Aya receives some devastating news.
I lost one of my ankles right now.
She posts a video to social media, speaking English this time, so the world can hear.
No one cares about us. We lost our families, our friends, and no one cares about this.
That was BBC's Lara El-Ghabali, and that report was produced by Haya Al-Badani. And you can watch Life and Death in Gaza tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. It's a special edition of Storyville from Gaza made by the BBC World Service Eye Investigations team. Now, it's hard to believe that it's 35 years since this.
This is the middle of the checkpoint. The police are making no attempt to stop people. The gates have been thrown open and thousands of people are pouring over to take a look at a West. In some cases, their first look, and the elation is enormous.
The late Brian Hanrahan reporting on the fall of the Berlin Wall for the BBC at the beginning of November 1989. Or more than 140 people were killed trying to cross from the east to the west in the nearly three decades that the wall existed. And today, justice has been served in a case dating back half a century. A German court convicted a former member of the East German secret police, the Stasi, of murdering a Polish firefighter who'd threatened to detonate a fake explosive if he wasn't allowed to cross to the West. That happened in 1974. The 10-year sentence was handed down to 80-year-old Martin Naumann, who's based on historical documents which revealed the firefighter Czesław Kukuczka had been granted an exit visa and even escorted to a crossing point. Believing that he was free, Kukuczka had begun to cross over before he was shot in the back. Now, I've been discussing the case and the painful memories it unearthed with German historian Katja Hoyer and Stefan Apelius, the historian who discovered the documents.
In the last 25 years, I was reading thousands, really thousands and thousands of files concerning East German history. And one day I stumbled upon this case by chance, I would say, during my research in the archives of this state security service. I was not looking for something special and I was reading everything.
And did you immediately realize it was a very special and unusual case?
Yes, because the story was written by a very high officer of state security service, a very important person. There was very much detailed information about what happened on this day at the end of March 1974 inside this report. It was very exciting for me to read this. And I was informed about the story of a young Polish firefighter. I was very excited about. And
Katja Hoyer, how unusual is this case and the fact there has now been this prosecution?
Well, I would say the case itself is unique in that it involves a foreign individual, it involves a terror threat, it involves the Stasi basically telling this individual that they can walk across the border and then shooting him in the back. So it's all almost like, you know, it came straight out of a spy novel or something. And then the fact that this is prosecuted so late is also fairly unusual in the sense that basically the authorities had kind of thought, you know, that they'd prosecuted everyone that there was to prosecute. Many of the individuals involved are now dead. And so this was really quite a unique case in every way that you look at it.
How has this case been perceived in Germany? How painful is this period of German history?
Well, it sort of opened up, again, a chapter that many people were kind of viewed as closed, in that it opened up again the whole debate around whether enough people were punished for the crimes committed by the German Democratic Republic, as East Germany was officially called, whether enough of the Stasi staff, but also perhaps the people who were informal informant, whether there's been enough punishment. That was a massive debate in the 1990s and then the early 2000s. You know, kind of, do you rake through everything? And that debate, I think many people felt, had kind of come to a natural end, had sort of petered out, and this case has kind of opened up back up again to some extent.
Well, Stefan, if I can turn to you again, do you have any idea if there are other cases like this still out there in the records to be found?
Yes, it could be. But normally the East German state security was working very professional. And in this case, they thought in the beginning, obviously, there is no danger. We can write down everything. And also the Polish state security service was involved. And for this reason, they produced a document with lots of top secret details, much more than in normal state security documents is written.
Katia, yes, as you say, one of the interesting things about this is it is a foreign victim, albeit in a Cold War context in which everyone there was part of the Eastern Bloc. I mean, it's hard to imagine something like that being covered up in many circumstances, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that's one of the reasons I think why it was so carefully covered up. I mean, you say it's all part of the same block, but that's sort of saying, you know, imagine a British security agency shooting a French citizen, and that's kind of what the acrimony would have been, I think, if this had turned into an international incident. And then, of course, you know, the relationship between Germany, be that East or West, and Poland was fraught still from the Second World War, from the fact that that border between the two countries was comparatively new after the Second World War. So this was a very, very sensitive situation, let's put it like that. And I think that that's part of the reason why the case was handled very differently, I would imagine, from other cases where East German citizens have tried to cross the border. You know, this sort of terror threat was involved in it, as well as the idea that he sort of threatened to explode, you know, his suitcase, which then turned out to be a bluff. I mean, most of the cases that we know where people were shot at the inner German border or at the Berlin Wall specifically were East German citizens trying to cross over into the West. And those who were caught, by and large, weren't then told, you know, to sort of walk over the border anyway, just to be shot in the back. They would arrest them. They would then often harass their families. They'd put them into prison. But this is a very distinct kind of scenario that doesn't really apply to other cases, as far as I know.
Hey, highly unusual Cold War cold case now solved. Those were the historians Katia Hoyer and Stefan Apelius. Just time now for our closing headline. Health officials in Lebanon say 21 people have been killed in what they say was an Israeli airstrike on I-2 in the north of the country. The apparent bombing would be the first Israeli attack on the Christian-majority area since the conflict with Hezbollah began more than a year ago. As the fighting intensifies in that country, UN peacekeeping forces in Lebanon say they will stay put despite Israeli calls for them to move. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.